WDJM Framingham.
All right, let's continue with our newspaper coverage and begin the reading of today's Boston Globe for this Friday, the 9th of January, 2026. And we say hello to Pam and Pamela.
Good morning, this is Pam.
And this is Pamela. State reiterates its ACA assistance. As Democrats spotlight affordability as a central campaign issue, Governor Maura Healey stood at a lectern Thursday to disclose the state's use of $250 million from a trust fund to help Massachusetts residents confronting skyrocketing premiums for health insurance they get through the Affordable Care Act. So here's what we're going to do, Healey said. We're going to use this trust fund money to provide more financial support where the federal government has taken those subsidies away, she said. The promise of action, however, downplayed that the financial commitment was not new and that it had already been baked into January insurance bills. Audrey Morse-Gasteyer, executive director of the Massachusetts Health Connector, said the financial bulwark that benefited 270,000 residents is part of the reason that we're hanging in there in terms of enrollment and keeping people covered. But Thursday's announcement won't translate into any additional help. Healey's news conference coincided with the beginning of an election year in which three Republicans are vying for her job, and voters are expected to be particularly focused on the state's high cost of living. One survey last year found Massachusetts had the second highest cost of living in the country. People who saw their insurance premiums increase this year said it was one pricey bill amid an onslaught of growing expenses. I can't believe how much it is when we go to the grocery store. Our electricity has gone up, said Judith O'Gara, whose family was hit with a $400 increase a month in insurance premiums for their ACA plan in January. We were just bracing ourselves to try and stretch the paycheck further. O'Gara, of Millis, is a part-time editor at community newspapers, and her husband is a self-employed computer animator and mural artist. She has added hours at work, she said, but it still wasn't enough to qualify for health coverage to her employer, leaving the couple to buy insurance through the connector. Healey also used a news conference to weigh in on a high-profile effort in Congress to revive the federal subsidies. Also on Thursday, the U.S. House, with help from 17 Republican defectors facing competitive re-election races, passed a bill that would extend the subsidies for another 3 years. A small group of senators is considering proposing their own extension of the subsidies. We need to see people in Congress step up and take action and fight the president on this and get him to focus on the domestic agenda and how to make life more affordable for people, Healey said. The governor said she didn't announce the influx of funds earlier because she had hoped Congress would act before the end of 2025. We gave up until the deadline to see if they take action, she said. ACA open enrollment extends through January 23rd. The infusion of funds from the Commonwealth Care Trust Fund brings the state's total commitment to the insurance marketplace to $600 million, which Healey said is the largest support from any state in the country. Federally subsidized insurance policies were first made available to people making less than 400% of the federal poverty level, or about $128,600 per family of four, in 2009 under President Barack Obama's ACA, also known as Obamacare. In 2021, Congress made those subsidies more generous for many recipients and extended them to people earning up to 500% of the federal poverty level. The expanded tax credits doubled participation in the ACA exchanges over the past 4 years, and by last year, 337,000 people in Massachusetts received subsidized insurance through Connector Care. The increases were slated to expire after 4 years, and without congressional action to preserve them, premiums reverted to pre-2021 levels for this year. People earning more than 400% of the poverty level become ineligible to receive subsidized insurance. State officials have estimated roughly 300,000 people could become uninsured statewide over the next decade, in part due to the expiration of the tax credits. Democrats staged a 43-day shutdown last fall, the longest in U.S. history, in an unsuccessful effort to preserve the expanded subsidies. The Commonwealth Care Trust Fund predates the 2021 coverage expansion, said Doug Howgate, president of the Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation, a nonprofit budget watchdog, and was established to support connector care programs. Massachusetts has long had a robust public insurance program, and the 2021 expansion essentially allowed the state to shift the cost of subsidies it had been paying to the federal government. Tapping the trust fund now essentially returns Massachusetts to the support levels it provided prior to 2021, Howgate said. Regardless of the timing of Haley's announcement, it is a reality that Massachusetts has a uniquely robust commitment to health insurance access, Howgate said. I do think that the idea that the state is able to offset some of those impacts is an important message to get out there, he said. This is real money. According to Haley's office, a 45-year-old couple with two kids making $75,000 in Fall River previously paid $166 per month for the lowest cost coverage. Without state action, their premium would have more than doubled. For the infusion from the trust fund, they will pay $206 per month. There's only so much the state can do to mitigate the impacts of the expired subsidies, though, because Congress didn't extend them. People between 400 and 500% of the federal poverty level simply are ineligible to sign up for subsidized policies through the ACA marketplace. There are roughly 27,000 people statewide who cannot benefit from the state's effort to compensate for the lost federal money, and those people are among those facing the biggest new insurance expenses. Krista, 56, a hairdresser, and her husband, Gary, 69, a truck driver, earn less than $105,750 annually combined, just shy of 500% of the poverty level. The couple, who asked not to be named to protect their privacy, went from paying $282 a month for Krista's insurance with no deductible to a private plan costing $725 a month with a $2,000 deductible. Gary, who's enrolled in Medicare, is still counting on Congress for a reprieve. I believe the Senate will be forced to do something, and we're hoping, he said.
For relatives of overdose victims, some much-needed help. The fund comes amid growing calls to direct more money from the multi-billion dollar opioid legal settlements to families affected by overdose deaths. At times, Sandra Spadafora feels trapped in the memory of the September afternoon in 2019 when she learned her 33-year-old son, Andrew Brown, had gone missing. There were frantic calls to Boston area hospitals and drug detoxification centers before a Suffolk County medical examiner confirmed her worst fears. A bruised body that matched Brown's description, with a distinctive tattoo saying, "Lost Soul," had been found in a Boston MBTA station. His official cause of death was a fentanyl overdose. Yet, before Spadafora could process her grief, another painful realization set in. After spending thousands of dollars on treatment and essentials for her adult son, who had struggled with substance abuse since he was a teenager, Spadafora had no money left to pay for a casket or a traditional burial. Instead, Brown would have to be cremated. Going through his death was devastating enough, but now you've got to worry about how to pay for everything, said Spadafora, who lives in Saugus. It added to the stress and the grief. Now, almost three decades into an opioid crisis that has claimed more than 1 million lives, Massachusetts is poised to become one of the first states to create a fund offering direct financial relief to families who have lost relatives to overdoses. In interviews, parents across Massachusetts describe going to extraordinary lengths to rescue their adult children from opioid addiction, sometimes draining their retirement accounts or borrowing on credit cards to pay for drug rehabilitation stays, counseling, hospital bills, and other costs. Often, parents are financially depleted by the time an adult child dies of an overdose, with no money to pay for burial plots, funeral services, or other essentials. A coalition of public and private agencies is rolling out a plan to provide $1.25 million over the next 3 years from legal settlements with the pharmaceutical industry to families of overdose victims. The money will pay for funeral expenses, behavioral health bills, legal fees, and other costs for residents of five as yet unnamed communities in Massachusetts that have been especially hard hit by the opioid epidemic. The fund will also provide financial support to grandparents who are raising their orphan grandchildren because their parents have died of overdoses. The new fund comes amid mounting frustrations over the fate of billions of dollars from the opioid settlements, which is intended to fight addiction but has largely gone unspent in Massachusetts. More than $50 billion is set to flow to state and local governments from legal settlements with drug manufacturers, distributors, and pharmacy chains for their role in flooding the nation with highly addictive painkillers. Massachusetts alone is set to receive $1 billion over the next 18 years. Yet, many families of overdose victims say the settlements have given too much power and money to local governments and far too little to individuals directly harmed by the aggressive sales practices of companies like Purdue Pharma, the maker of the powerful painkiller OxyContin. In Massachusetts, where more than 20,000 people have died from overdoses in the past decade, the vast majority of the settlement payouts are still sitting in government coffers. Less than 8% of the $91 million that municipalities have received was spent on addiction-related services and overdose prevention efforts as of June 2024, according to a state dashboard. Only 2% of the money has gone directly to support families, which mirrors the national pattern, according to an analysis by Christy Minhey, an attorney and founder of OpioidSettlementTracker.com. What does it say about our society if we let someone die of an overdose and then don't support their grieving families? Said Elsa Gomez Bondlow, co-founder and chief impact officer of Halo Initiatives, a nonprofit that will manage the fund. It sends a message twice that they aren't worthy of our care, not in life and not in death. The idea of a dedicated fund to support families harmed by opioid overdoses took root in Boston a decade ago. Responding to a sharp rise in opioid overdoses, former Boston Mayor Martin Walsh in 2015 created the Office of Recovery Services, the first city office of its kind in the nation, which sought to connect people struggling with addiction to treatment and peer support services. Soon after its launch, the office began receiving calls from grieving residents who had lost relatives to overdoses and had no money to pay for funerals and burial expenses. Brendan Little, then policy director of the Office of Recovery Services, said he was dismayed to discover that no financial assistance was available. There was a state office that provided financial assistance to victims of homicides and other violent crimes, but that money didn't extend to families of fatal overdose victims. Many of the families only sought a couple of thousand dollars to buy a casket or defray the cost of a funeral. The median cost of a full funeral with burial was $8,300 in 2023. Still, the idea proved to be a tough sell. Many addiction specialists and a state advisory panel charged with overseeing the distribution of the opioid settlement funds wanted to use the money for addiction prevention, particularly at a time when more than 2,000 people in Massachusetts were dying of overdoses each year. It's a final indignity when a family can't afford to bury a loved one, and no one should have to go through it, said Little, now executive director and co-founder of Halo Initiatives. But giving money to families wasn't very popular. The focus was on saving the lives of the people who are still here. Yet the concept gained momentum in the summer of 2023, when the Boston Public Health Commission held an expansive series of community listening sessions on how to use Boston's share of the settlement funds. A majority of the more than 600 participants said that they wanted to prioritize the financial needs of the grieving families. Soon after, Boston established the first municipal fund in the nation dedicated specifically to families of overdose victims. The fund has distributed roughly $220,000 to 53 families in Boston. Among those who stand to benefit from the dedicated funds are grandparents raising orphan grandchildren, a large and often overlooked population of older Americans whose lives have been upended by the overdose crisis. From 2011 to 2021, nearly 322,000 children lost a parent to drug overdoses. Many grandparents raising orphan grandchildren are living on fixed incomes, yet face ongoing expenses for summer camp, extracurricular activities, and driver's education classes. These costs that they didn't anticipate or prepare for. Phyllis Virtual of Fall River is among those who never expected to be raising grandchildren. In early 2017, she quit her job at a group home for adults with brain injuries to care for her two grandchildren, including a newborn less than 1 month old, after her 29-year-old daughter, Caitlin, died of a fentanyl overdose. Lacking the money to pay for her daughter's burial, Fertifuel had to set up a campaign on GoFundMe to raise money for cremation instead. And then came the bills for baby formula, diapers, clothing, and other expenses. It's plain wrong that so much of this opioid settlement is going unspent while families who are harmed by Big Pharma are still struggling. If more people felt what we felt, then they would help us. As for Spadafora, she has built a memorial to Brown in her living room in Saugus with photos of her son and gifts given to her after he died. The memorial includes an urn containing his ashes above the words, "I love you to the moon and back."
In Minneapolis, a singular death and two versions. Officials say they're being blocked from investigation. Disputes between Minnesota officials and the Trump administration intensified Thursday over who would investigate the killing of a woman by federal agent in southern Minneapolis after the state withdrew because federal officials had denied it access to evidence. The death of Renee Nicole Good, 37, prompted furious demonstrations, and protesters were met with tear gas at a federal building Thursday morning. Documents obtained by the New York Times suggest that at least 100 more federal agents were being deployed to Minnesota. And Governor Tim Walz activated the state's National Guard out of an abundance of caution, according to his office, though the troops have not yet been deployed. Mayor Jacob Frey of Minneapolis said in an interview that the Trump administration would use any chaos as an opportunity to occupy Minneapolis in some form. "Our community members are not taking the bait," he said. Across the continent, another shooting by federal immigration officers has shaken a community. The FBI's office in Portland, Oregon, said it was investigating an agent involved in a shooting that happened around 2:15 p.m. Two people were reported wounded. According to the Portland Police Bureau, officers initially responded to a report of a shooting near a hospital. A few minutes later, police received information that a man who had been shot was asking for help in a different area, a couple of miles away. Officers then responded there and found the two people with apparent gunshot wounds. Officers determined they were injured in the shooting with federal agents, police said. Their conditions were not immediately known. In Minneapolis, officials have described the killing of Good in starkly different terms. She was killed Wednesday during a protest on a residential street as federal agents ordered her to move her vehicle. Administration officials, including President Trump, defended the shooting as lawful, saying the agent who fired was acting in self-defense. City and state officials described those accounts as propaganda and garbage. A video analysis shows that the woman's vehicle appeared to be turning away from the officer as he opened fire. State officials initially said they would investigate the killing, but Drew Evans, superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, said Thursday that the agency had withdrawn because it had been denied access to evidence. Walz said at a news conference that Minnesota must be part of this investigation. "I say that only because people in positions of power have already passed judgment," Walz added. He said that some of the federal government's statements regarding the circumstances of the shooting had been verifiably false. At a news conference in New York City, Christine Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, said that Minnesota and Minneapolis officials had failed to maintain order. "They have not been cut out," Noem told a reporter who had asked about the state investigators. "They don't have any jurisdiction in this investigation." At a White House press briefing, Vice President J.D. Vance doubled down on claims about the shooting, calling news reporters agents of propaganda of a radical fringe, for reports indicating that Good never put the ICE agent in danger before she was shot. Last year, the federal agent who shot Good, identified as Jonathan Ross, was dragged about 100 yards by a different driver during an immigration operation in Minnesota, interviews and court records show. He and other agents had been trying to apprehend a Guatemalan man who had been convicted of sexual abuse. Ross was treated for a gash on his forearm that required 20 stitches after the episode, for which the driver was convicted of assault last month. On social media, Attorney General Pam Bondi warned protesters in Minnesota not to cross a red line into obstructing, impeding, or attacking federal law enforcement. Protests against immigration and customs enforcement action in Minneapolis have occurred for weeks, but Good's killing ratcheted up the tension. Demonstrators gathered Thursday at the Bishop Henry Whipple Federal Building just outside the city, the home of the local ICE headquarters. By 9 a.m., Federal agents had pushed protesters across the street after deploying tear gas. The building also houses an immigration court, which was closed Thursday. Public schools were also closed across the city and will remain so on Friday because of safety concerns related to incidents around the city, school officials said in a statement. Many local and state leaders have been warning for weeks that the surge of immigration enforcement work was bound to stoke chaos. Waltz put the blame squarely on Trump and Noem, asking them to pull back federal agents and declaring at a Wednesday news conference, "You've done enough. Now, more federal agents are on the way." Pam?
Threat to Greenland gets GOP pushback. Military talk brings criticism. Many Republicans are downplaying the Trump administration's threat to use military force to seize Greenland, while some GOP lawmakers denounce what they say would be a senseless attack on a longtime U.S. partner that could splinter the NATO alliance. "I don't think anybody's seriously considering that," House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, said of a potential military annexation of the territory while speaking with reporters Wednesday. "In the Congress, we are certainly not." On Tuesday, Senate Majority Leader John Thune, a South Dakota Republican, also dismissed the possibility, saying he did not see military action being an option there. Other GOP lawmakers have been more openly critical. In a statement, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the GOP chair of the Senate panel on defense spending, called the administration's comments unseemly and counterproductive, warning that any military action would be an especially catastrophic act of strategic self-harm to America and its global influence. Their comments came days after Stephen Miller, a White House deputy chief of staff, told CNN that Greenland should obviously be part of the United States, in the wake of a daring U.S. military raid to capture Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. The split between leadership in the GOP-controlled Congress and the White House underscores the tensions in the party over the president's military adventurism. Even as most Republicans have backed Trump's military strikes around the world, including in Yemen, Iran, and Venezuela, threatening a NATO ally is going too far, some lawmakers warn. Denmark and Greenland's envoys to Washington, meanwhile, have begun a vigorous effort to urge U.S. lawmakers, as well as key Trump administration officials, to step back from President Trump's call for a takeover of the strategic Arctic island. Denmark's ambassador, Jesper Møller Sørensen, and Jacob Isbjørnsen, Greenland's chief representative to Washington, met on Thursday with White House National Security Council officials to discuss a renewed push by Trump to acquire Greenland, perhaps by military force, according to Danish government officials. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is expected to meet next week with Danish officials. GOP lawmakers have largely framed Trump's threats to seize the island as a negotiating tactic, but that position is becoming more tenuous as senior officials affirm military force as an option and the administration intervenes in foreign countries elsewhere. Greenland is an autonomous territory of Denmark, a U.S. ally and NATO member. The administration's veiled warnings have prompted outcry from other European allies, many of whom see military action against the island as a red line in their relationships with Washington. While many Republican members of Congress cast doubt on the possibility that the administration would forcibly annex Greenland, others sharply criticized the vague threats coming from the highest levels of the White House. "I'm so sick of stupid," Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, who co-chairs the Senate panel on NATO, said in a rest-of-floor speech Wednesday. "The amateurs who said it was a good idea should lose their jobs," he continued, referencing Miller's comments on Monday. During a classified briefing with select lawmakers on Monday, Secretary of State Marco Rubio indicated that the president's goal was to purchase the territory, an overture that Denmark has repeatedly dismissed.
Former GLP-1 users regain lost weight after about 18 months, a lifestyle change called crucial. People who stop taking GLP-1 drugs such as Ozempic and Wegovy for weight loss are projected to regain their shed pounds within about 1.5 years, a review of existing research has found. The paper also found that former users of a wider list of weight loss drugs regain weight 4 times more quickly than those who had used behavioral techniques like dieting or exercise. For sustained health benefits after coming off the drug, scientists say it's necessary to make lasting changes to your diet and exercise regime. Millions of Americans use the drugs, which work with remarkable effectiveness by cutting cravings for food, slowing digestion, and keeping you feeling full for longer. But so far, there has been comparatively less research on what happens when users stop taking the drugs. Researchers analyzed 37 studies on how people coped after coming off weight loss medications, although only 6 of the studies were on semaglutide and tirzepatide, among the most widely prescribed categories of weight loss drugs. People who come off the popular drugs Ozempic, Wegovy, and Zepbound are projected to return to their baseline weight after an average of 18 months. When looking at a total of 13 weight loss medications, users were projected to return to their baseline weight after 20 months, still about 4 times faster than someone coming off a behavioral program, such as a diet. In addition to regaining weight, people returned to pre-drug levels of key markers of cardiometabolic health, including blood pressure and cholesterol, about 17 months after coming off all weight loss drugs. The peer-reviewed paper, published Wednesday in the British Medical Journal, analyzed 37 studies following 9,300 participants on 13 weight loss medications. People who take the most common categories of weight loss drugs, semaglutide and tirzepatide, marketed as Ozempic, Wegovy, and Zepbound, tended to lose about 33 pounds during their treatment, but then regained about 22 pounds in the first year after stopping. Sam West, a physiology researcher at Oxford University who co-wrote the study, said in a phone interview Thursday, "What was particularly striking in our data was just how fast it was regained," he said. Whereas previous estimates suggest that people regain weight loss in semaglutide or tirzepatide within the 2 or 3 years, West said the analysis put the timeline at just 18 months. In Britain, where West is based, government guidance estimates the weight would be regained after about 3 years. Giles Yao, a professor of genetics at Cambridge University, who specializes in food intake and did not work on the study, said the findings were not surprising. "Many people forget that GLP-1s are drugs like any other," he said in a phone interview Thursday. "And like most drugs, with the exception of vaccines, they typically only work when you're on them," he said. Yao compared the drugs to medication for high blood pressure. "When your blood pressure is normalized, no one ever says, 'Gee, I'm going to stop now taking my pill,' because what happens if you stop is, almost immediately, your blood pressure will become abnormal again. Now, clearly it takes longer to regain weight, but the same is going to be true for these weight loss drugs." Yao also cautioned the study had a number of limitations and said more research is needed. "Given so many people are taking these drugs," Yao said, "he expects longer-term trial data to emerge in the coming years that will provide a more certain picture. The review underscores our existing understanding that it's difficult to maintain weight loss after coming off such injections. One study in 2022, for example, found that participants had regained about 2/3 of their prior weight loss about a year after coming off a weekly semaglutide injection, roughly in line with the review's averages. As millions of Americans use GLP-1s, scientists expect an increasing focus in the coming years on how users can maintain their weight loss. Studies have shown that as many as half of users quit the drugs within a year because of their cost, unwanted side effects, or other reasons. But weight loss medications can pave the way for more sustainable strategies to keep the weight off, namely exercise and improved diet. Yao suggests thinking about weight loss drugs as a tool for people to build healthier lifestyles while they're on them, with the goal of making it easier to come off the drugs and maintain the weight. "I'm not saying this is easy, but you now have a set of tools, recipes, habits, a new bicycle route to work that you can just call upon when the going gets tough."
Kennedy shakes up the food pyramid. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on Wednesday unveiled new dietary guidelines that address everything from gut health to alcohol consumption to breastfeeding. Like previous versions, the new food pyramid urges Americans to limit their intake of added sugar, alcohol, and refined carbohydrates, like white bread. But in a departure, the new guidance explicitly warns consumers to avoid highly processed foods like chips and cookies, recommends more protein, and de-emphasizes lean meat and low-fat dairy. In the healthy fat category, officials include beef tallow, an ingredient similar to lard and butter. The Globe asked nutrition experts to weigh in on this news. Here's what they said. How is this guidance different from what became before? The original food pyramid, introduced by the USDA in 1992, created a clear hierarchy categorized by food groups. At the top were foods to eat sparingly, such as red meat and butter. And at the bottom were foods to prioritize, such as whole grains, fruit, vegetables, and healthy fats. The new model appears as though HHS just took the pyramid, inverted it, and gave it a good shake, said Jose Ordovas, a senior scientist at the Jean Mayer USDA Human Nutrition Research Center on Aging at Tufts University. Grains appear at the bottom tip of the inverted pyramid, although consumers are told to prioritize them, while protein, dairy, healthy fats, fruits, and vegetables dominate the wide top. The guidelines also recommend consuming full-fat dairy products, while previous versions emphasized low-fat or fat-free dairy. Fengfeng Zhang, a nutrition and cancer epidemiologist at the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts, commended the focus on fat quality. Rather than chasing the low-fat label, Zhang said, many Americans choose low or non-fat dairy products, even when that fat is replaced with sugars or other additives. I'm worried, actually, that the chocolate low-fat milk that gets into our school meals. Kids get those in school, but not the whole-fat milk. That needs to be changed. Another difference lies in limits to alcohol consumption. HHS shifted from specifying daily limits, 2 drinks per day for men, 1 for women, to a general directive to consume less alcohol for better health. What are some positive changes in the new guidelines? Experts praise the guidelines' warnings to avoid processed foods. Zhang, a nutrition and cancer epidemiologist, said ultra-processed foods make up more than half the calories that Americans consume and have been linked to obesity and other chronic diseases. Zhang also appreciated the guidelines' clear messaging on carbohydrate quality, referring to their emphasis on whole grains, not refined grains. Refined grains, such as white bread, white rice, flour tortillas, are considered low-quality carbohydrates because some of their parts, the bran and the germ, are removed, leading to a loss of nutrients. What elements of the new guidelines are controversial? Zhang said she believes that health officials should exercise more caution in their messaging around protein. The new guidelines say to prioritize protein foods at every meal, including red meat, seafood, poultry, and plant-based sources. Americans already meet their overall protein needs, she said, so the focus should be on the kinds of protein Americans are consuming. We are not meeting the recommended intake. We are exceeding, she said. We are consuming more protein from red and processed meat. Both are strongly associated with adverse health outcomes, including cancer, Zhang said. What is beef tallow? And should you cook with it? The new guidelines recommended cooking with olive oil, but also suggested using butter or beef tallow, a rendered purified beef fat made by slow cooking and straining beef. While flavorful, beef tallow is high in saturated fat and calorically dense. Kennedy has suggested that it's healthier than seed oils. According to the Mayo Clinic, beef tallow has a unique fat profile that may make it healthier than some of the other saturated fats. In tallow, some of the saturated fat is a specific type known as stearic acid. Stearic acid appears not to raise cholesterol in the same way as other saturated fats. The guidelines say more research is needed to determine which type of fats are the healthiest. What happened to the Mediterranean diet? The new guidelines contrast with the highly regarded Mediterranean diet, which health organizations and nutritionists
have praised for its benefits to overall and heart health, disease prevention, and longevity. The Mediterranean diet gets its name from the Mediterranean region of Europe and centers around minimally processed, plant-based foods, according to the American Heart Association. The new guidelines aren't discarding diets like the Mediterranean, Ordova said, rather trying to encourage people to integrate as much as possible all kinds of real foods into their day-to-day consumption. How will these changes affect people's lives? Ordova suggested people may start opting for more protein in their meals and examining labels more in the grocery store to avoid added sugar. They may also choose to cook more at home rather than go out to eat, looking for nutrient-dense meals over empty calories. The purpose of the guidelines is to provide the foundation for federal nutrition programs and policies. It's more about getting the big picture to shift a few important, more prevalent issues that we should address, Zhang said.
Healy targets airlines profiting from ICE. Governor Maura Healy on Thursday asked the leaders of two private airlines conducting federal immigration detention flights in Massachusetts and elsewhere to get out of the deportation business. In her plea, Healy cited the killing on Wednesday of Renee Nicole Macklin Good, a U.S. citizen, by a federal immigration agent in Minneapolis, and an announcement by Avilo Airlines that it would end charter flights for federal immigration detainees on January 27th. Healy's plea was in a letter addressed to leaders of Eastern Airlines in Kansas City, Missouri, and Global X in Miami. Both provide charter flight services for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. She said the Trump administration is using the flights to transport people to other states where their cases are heard far from their homes and families and obstruct their due process rights. Last month, Healy demanded ICE halt immigration flights from Hanscom Field, a state-run airport a short drive from the federal agency's field office in Burlington. Flying these residents out of state, often within hours of arrest, is intentionally cruel and purposely obstructs the due process and legal representation they're entitled to, Healy said. By contracting with ICE to execute these flights, you are profiting off these anti-American tactics and facilitating the obstruction of due process. The Globe on Thursday sent requests for comment to the airlines, ICE, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, which oversees the Federal Immigration Enforcement Agency. The Trump administration has previously defended the flights as an effective tool for carrying out the president's deportation agenda. Critics said the Trump administration uses domestic flights to move detainees rapidly from where they were arrested to remote ICE facilities in states like Texas and Louisiana, where judges are often more conservative and less likely to grant release. Federal immigration officials have used Hanscom to transport detainees since at least 2014. Since the start of Trump's second term, ICE chartered planes have departed Hanscom 112 times and flown to 17 domestic airports as of November 30th, according to ICE Flight Monitor, part of the nonprofit Human Rights First. Nationally, the group said, domestic ICE flights have more than doubled since 2024, and trips overseas have increased by 41%, as Trump carried out more than 605,000 deportations. A commission representing communities covered by Hanscom Field has been pressing ICE for flight information, and demonstrators have been gathering outside the airport to protest the operations. In November, the Hanscom Airfield Commission posed questions to ICE about its operations at the airport and invited a representative to attend its December meeting. The agency provided a meaningless response to the questions and didn't send a representative to the meeting, according to the commission. On December 27th, the commission sent further questions to the ICE representative and invited him to attend a meeting on January 20th. Hanscom Field is run by the Massachusetts Port Authority. The agency has said it cannot legally prohibit the flights and does not receive advance notice.
The First Friday explained why the jobs report is more important than ever this year, by Larry Edelman, Globe columnist. The first Friday of the month is a big deal in the financial world. It's the day when the Employment Situation Summary, a.k.a. the U.S. Jobs Report, is published. Despite its prosaic title, the report is perhaps the most significant economic indicator compiled by the government or private sector. It not only shapes Americans' views of their financial prospects and the president's economic leadership, but plays a key role in Federal Reserve interest rate decisions. The jobs data are especially important this year. It's simply not clear whether the slowing labor market is signaling an economic downturn. The December report comes out this Friday. The consensus among forecasters is that the unemployment rate dipped 0.1 percentage points to 4.5%, while employers added 70,000 jobs, a modest improvement from the previous month. It will be the first clean report after distortions caused by the government shutdown, which started in October. Investors and economists will analyze every detail to determine whether the low hire, low fire environment that's prevailed since May is shifting for better or worse. Markets will likely swing on the news. But have you ever wondered where the jobs numbers come from, how to make sense of them, and why seemingly good news sends stocks lower? If so, here's a primer. The surveys say, the unemployment rate and the number of jobs added or shed by employers are the two headlines generated by the report, which is produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics from two large surveys it conducts each month. BLS collects employment and earnings data from roughly 121,000 businesses and government agencies, covering about one-third of all non-farm workers. It would be impossible to reach every employer in the country. There were nearly 6 million in 2023. So the results are estimates based on the large statistical sample and adjusted for seasonal factors such as holiday retail hiring and winter construction slowdowns. Note, the establishment survey tracks jobs, not people. Two part-time jobs filled at different firms by the same worker are both counted. Separately, BLS contacts about 60,000 households, representing some 110,000 individuals, and asks about their employment status. Do they have a job? Are they actively looking for one? How long have they been out of work? A person is counted once, even if they hold multiple jobs. And unlike the establishment survey, the self-employed and farm workers are included in the totals. The unemployment rate is the estimated number of people without a job, but searching for one, as a percentage of the labor force, which comprises job holders and job hunters. Mixed signals. Sometimes the surveys flash conflicting messages. In a given month, employers might report adding 100,000 jobs while the unemployment rate rises. And how can that be? The jobless rate can increase when more people enter the labor force and start looking for employment. They join the ranks of the unemployed until they land a job. Conversely, the unemployment rate can fall even when employers shed jobs if enough people leave the labor force. Digging deeper. Secondary metrics such as wage growth, labor force participation, the percentage of the population 16 years and older who are in the workforce, and the U6 jobless rate reveal crucial nuances about labor market health. Changes in average hourly earnings show whether workers have bargaining power and if wage growth risks fueling inflation. The labor force participation rate indicates whether workers are entering or exiting job market. The U6 rate, which includes part-time workers who would rather be working full-time and those marginally attached to the workforce, exposes hidden slack that the narrower unemployment rate misses. What makes a good or bad jobs report? Context is the key. For example, in 2021 and 2022, job gains averaged about 490,000 a month as the economy staged a powerful recovery from pandemic disruptions in 2020. As the expansion matured over the next 2 years, monthly employment growth slowed to around 190,000, but the jobless rate remained relatively tame compared with long-term levels. Last year, hiring averaged just 55,000 through November, not enough to prevent unemployment from climbing to 4.6%. That rate was markedly above the post-COVID low of 3.4%, but still comfortably below the 5.8% average of the past 20 years. Why do stocks fall sometimes even when the jobs news is good? Well, this question brings us back to the Fed. The central bank's job is to promote maximum employment and low, steady inflation. Low interest rates encourage hiring. High rates keep price gains in check. But a very tight job market might signal an overheating economy, raising concerns that inflation could spike. That puts pressure on the Fed to boost rates, which stock investors dislike because it makes bonds more attractive and squeezes corporate profits. Final thoughts. Fed policymakers are split on whether inflation or further job market deterioration is a bigger threat to the economy. Investors are betting that employment falls enough to prompt the Fed to cut rates twice this year. But a strong December jobs report could upend those expectations.
It's America's first music. Conductor Everett McCorvey on the importance of preserving Negro spirituals. At Mechanics Hall, 321 Main Street, Worcester, January 10th at 7 p.m. Tickets $50 for adults, $20 for students, $10 for youth. MusicWorcester.org. As the United States enters its 250th year, it boasts a rich and varied musical legacy. But for conductor Everett McCorvey, American Negro spirituals stand apart from the rest of the country's songbook. It's America's first music. He said of the songs that enslaved people created when they mixed African rhythms with the European hymns they heard in mandatory church services. The immigrants who came to this country brought their own music with them. It was not until the blossoming of the spiritual that America found its voice. Today, even as the more contemporary sounds of gospel fill most black sacred spaces, the thunderous spirituals continue to thrive, thanks in large part to the American Spiritual Ensemble, a group that McCorvey founded 30 years ago. Many of those spirituals will be taught and sung in central Massachusetts over the next 18 months, while McCorvey serves as Music Worcester's artist in residence. His residency begins Saturday with an American Spiritual Ensemble concert at Mechanics Hall and continues with school workshops and concerts that will find McCorvey conducting the Worcester Chorus. McCorvey's childhood in Montgomery, Alabama, was full of black sacred music as well as civil rights activism. To this day, every American Spiritual Ensemble concert starts and ends with Walk Together Children, a spiritual that Martin Luther King Jr. often quoted in his sermons. My mother was a Methodist, my father was a Baptist, and luckily their churches were just a block apart, McCorvey remembered in a Zoom conversation from his home in Lexington, Kentucky, where he teaches voice at the University of Kentucky. When choirs from historically black colleges visited, a young McCorvey heard this beautiful a cappella music that moved me greatly. Early in his career as an opera singer, McCorvey noticed that gospel music was exploding, but American Negro spirituals were not. I wanted to make sure that this music that I felt was so important to the American musical canon was not lost. McCorvey said that spirituals are a sound that people all over the world try to emulate, thanks to techniques like call and response that originated in spirituals and are now a staple of popular music. Besides drawing on thousands of spirituals that have been passed down from generation to generation, the ensemble also includes African percussion, jazz, and Broadway songs like Summertime and Old Man River to demonstrate where the spirituals came from and how they influenced American culture. When McCorvey founded the American Spiritual Ensemble in 1995, he drew on his colleagues in opera to world to fill out its roster. He said, "It's still exciting when he hears the combination of all these big voices that could fill a concert hall by themselves." One of those great voices belongs to Kenneth Overton, who will be part of Saturday's performance. The ensemble uses proceeds from its concerts to fund recordings by members of its roster. The most recent one is Overton's The Living Spiritual, which features new arrangements by living black composers of 23 traditional spirituals. Music Worcester's Artist in Residency program began in 2019 and has included pianist Simone Dinnerstein and violinist Avinjan Gupta. Besides performances with organizations like the Worcester Chorus, the visiting residents engage with the Worcester Public Schools and via the Opportunity Program, the Worcester County Jail. Music Worcester Executive Director Adrian Finley said McCorvey was a natural choice for the residency because of the wide range of music he works with. He launched his career playing trumpet. He still performs as a tenor. He leads the opera program in Kentucky, and, oh, by the way, he also leads the National Chorale and Orchestra of New York City with their annual engagement at Lincoln Center, Finley said. He's also a sought-after guest conductor and is highly involved with living composers and new works. As we began the planning process with Everett, it became clear that his amazing ideas could not be limited to 12 months. So here we go with our first 18-month residency, Finley added. Current plans for residency include a program of Johannes Brahms' vocal works and a program of pieces by Margaret Bond and Paul Moravec that will commemorate America's 250th anniversary. To cap it off, in 2027, we're aiming to have a culminating public event that would feature a commission by a major living composer, said Finley. The day before the Mechanics Hall concert, the American Spiritual Ensemble will perform at Doherty Memorial High School, where the audience will include members of area high school choir groups and Black student union organizations. McCorvey will return to the school in March for more educational collaborations. For some of our students, spirituals are already something they have a strong personal connection with. For other students, they will discover how spirituals gave us everything else to American music, said Lisa Leach, District Performing Arts Curriculum Specialist for the Worcester Public Schools. Spirituals as a genre are so powerful on so many levels, emotionally, personally, spiritually, historically, and as an understanding of what people can hope for and dream of. McCorvey agreed that spirituals are for everyone to learn and experience. He recently met with a mostly non-Black college choir whose members did not want to sing spirituals because they thought it would be cultural appropriation. I told them, "You pay honor to us by performing this music," said McCorvey, who pointed out that it was a Czech-American composer, Antonín Dvořák, who played a major role in bringing spirituals into concert halls after Black composer Harry Burley introduced Dvořák to them. "This music is for everybody," McCorvey added. "It tells of a very important time in our American history. It's a story that I want every community to learn."
Aldrich Ames, CIA counterintelligence turncoat, who helped the Soviets, dies at age 84. Aldrich Ames, the most murderous turncoat in the history of the Central Intelligence Agency, whose betrayal in working for the Soviet Union went undetected for almost a decade, died Monday. He was 84 and had been a federal prisoner, serving life without parole since 1994. The death was recorded in the Federal Bureau of Prisons inmate database. A spokesperson said he died at the Federal Correctional Institution in Cumberland, Maryland. The son of an alcoholic CIA officer, Mr. Ames moved upward through the agency ranks for 17 years until he attained a headquarters post of extraordinary sensitivity. He became the chief of the counterintelligence branch of the CIA's Soviet division in September of 1983. He had access to some of the nation's deepest secrets, in particular, its clandestine liaisons with the Soviets who worked with U.S. intelligence. This was a small cadre, barely a dozen, who were cultivated over the course of two decades and well-placed in Soviet government agencies and embassies around the world. As the Cold War was cresting, Mr. Ames decided that he would change the course of history by upending a long-running game of nations, a contest of spy versus spy. He saw it as a charade. By his own account, he was fueled by a toxic cocktail of vodka, arrogance, delusions of grandeur, and naked greed. In April 1985, he took his first gamble. He hand-delivered an envelope addressed to the KGB chief at the Soviet embassy in Washington. He offered a smattering of CIA secrets and requested $50,000 in return. He identified himself by name and rank. The relationship was sealed over a long, boozy lunch at an elegant hotel near the White House. Then he bet the house. Mr. Ames feared that one of the CIA's Russians might betray him, so he decided to betray them all. He knew he would be paid a fortune. "I panicked," he said in a 1994 interview with the New York Times, conducted from jail. Only by suddenly giving them everyone would he be protected, and he knew in return that he would be paid as much money as I could ever use, if I chose to do that. Mr. Ames put together hundreds of secret documents in a 6-pound stack, a who's who of Soviets working for the CIA, and an encyclopedia of U.S. intelligence operations behind the Iron Curtain. He stuffed them into his briefcase, walked out of headquarters, and delivered them to a contact at the Soviet embassy. "I was delivering myself along with them," he said in the interview. "I was saying, 'Over to you, KGB. You guys take care of me now.' The KGB took care of him. He was paid at least $2.7 million, and it took care of its own turncoats. As many as 10 Soviet and Soviet bloc spies were arrested, interrogated, and executed for treason. One was imprisoned, at least two escaped, one step ahead of their pursuers. The network that had provided the United States with the political, military, diplomatic, and intelligence insights on Moscow was destroyed. The KGB did its best to fill that void with disinformation and double agents for the rest of the Cold War. These deceptions distorted the debate over policy and strategy towards Moscow at the highest levels of U.S. government. John Deutsch, the CIA's director in 1995, said at the time that they had subverted the CIA in its central mission of the Cold War, understanding the Soviet threat. The falsehood sustained the view that the Soviet Union was a superpower, even as it was collapsing. In 1986, Mr. Ames went on a three-year assignment in Rome, where he devoted much of his time to rooting out secrets for the Soviets and drinking his lunch. He once passed out in the street after a U.S. embassy party. Then in 1989, a CIA officer reported that Mr. Ames was inexplicably wealthy. He had paid $540,000 in cash for a new home near the agency's headquarters, and he was driving a new Jaguar. This set off the faintest of alarms. The agency's clandestine service took more than a year to forward these concerns to its internal security office. That office assigned one investigator to the case, an inexperienced man in his 20s, who put the investigation aside for months. It wasn't until 1993 that a formal criminal investigation began, spurred in large part by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The FBI put handcuffs on Mr. Ames on February 21, 1994, and he became a prisoner from that day on. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to the Talking Information Center. I'm Pam.
I'm Pamela.
Have a great day.
These are the death notices from Friday, January 9th, 2026. From Arlington, James E. Toner. From Beverly, Nora Jean Salvato. From Billerica, James E. Toner. From Boston, Oscar Ferlani Jr. From Burlington, Mary Louise Cochran. From Chelsea, Nora Jean Salvato. From Dartmouth, Christine Mary Collins. From Dorchester, Teresa A. Cunningham. From East Boston, Oscar Forlani Jr. From Falmouth, Mary Jane Kelly. From Georgetown, James E. Toner. From Higham, Teresa A. Cunningham. From Lawrence, Mary Jane Kelly. From Middleton, Oscar Ferlani Jr. From Millis, Christine Mary Collins. From Needham, Christine Mary Collins. From Norwood, Christine Mary Collins. From Plymouth, Mary Louise Cochran. From Reading, Janine B. Walker. From Roxbury, Teresa A. Cunningham. From Somerville, James E. Toner. From Swampscott, Oscar Ferlani Jr. From Walpole, Mary Louise Cochran. From Waltham, Mary Louise Cochran. From Watertown, Pascal Bianco. From Wellesley, Janet Marie Brine. From Winthrop, Oscar Furlani Jr. And from Woburn, James E.